On this episode of Video Culture, we'll talk coming-of-age movies set in the 80s with Whitewater Summer and Lucas.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills, there will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome, and thank you for tuning in for another great episode of Video Culture. I'm Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And like I said on the intro, this week's episode is about coming-of-age movies set in the 80s. And when I mean set by the 80s, they were also, you know, filmed in the 80s.
They weren't period films at the time. Right? They were just current films.
They were not like done in the 2000s about the 80s.
No, 90s.
These were 80s movies in the 80s.
Yes. And a very common genre in the 1980s, right? There were a lot of these kind of movies in the 1980s.
Right. I mean, you already had like Goonies and, you know,
Can't Buy Me Love and, you know, things like that. I mean, there were a lot of those kind of flicks where the kid was in high school and he learned
Breakfast
lessons.
Breakfast Club.
Yeah, exactly. John Hughes made a career out
John
of
John Hughes. I mean, anything John Hughes. Like that, mostly yeah. John Hughes in his early career.
Yeah.
You know, Pretty in Pink.
Yeah.
All of that stuff. I mean, Some Kind of Wonderful, St. Elmo's Fire.
Yeah. I mean, you have these stories of young people kind of becoming adults or young adults becoming older adults and really learning about life, love, and all of that.
Yeah.
Usually set to really good 80s music.
Yeah, and we even covered one of these a couple episodes back when we covered Heathers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a dark spin on that, but
yeah.
But still kind of in the same wheelhouse.
Right, and that wasn't really a parody, and it wasn't really, it was really the darker side or the more cynical side.
It was a cynical take on the idea, yeah, for sure.
So we'll start with this one movie, Whitewater Summer.
It's a pretty obscure film.
Right, very obscure. I did not realize how obscure it was until recently.
Well, you told me, you asked me if I wanted to watch it for this episode. I'm like, what is that?
It was the one movie, there's not a lot of movies that you haven't seen.
At least that I don't have some concept of.
So I was surprised that I saw this movie and you hadn't.
Yeah, you mentioned it, I just stared at you blankly. And you're like, it's got Kevin Bacon in it.
And Kevin Bacon.
And I'm like, no idea what you're talking about.
Who isn't he? I mean, isn't he the guy that connects all the actors?
That is true. And so there's one more connection for you people. But yeah, so it stars Kevin Bacon and Sean Astin.
A very young Sean Astin.
A very young Sean Astin.
So he must have done that. This was 1987. So he did Goonies was what, 1986?
Yeah. I don't know if that I want to say 86. We can look it up really quickly.
Okay.
I will vamp for you.
So, but yeah, And Sean Astin really is the main character that you follow in the story. Yeah.
He's the protagonist. In a lot of ways, Kevin Bacon is the antagonist, though it's not your typical hero-villain film. But Whitewater Summer, it's a really unusual film. It's hard. It's almost hard to even begin to explain it. It's basically about this kid who's sort of your typical like nerdy guy. He likes chess. He likes reading. He's, I think he's 13 going on 14.
Well, you get the sense already that he's from a rich family.
Yes.
He lives in New York City on like the Upper East Side.
Yeah.
He, and every summer his parents are like, you know, trying to get rid of him basically.
Yeah, they're like, go to computer camp, go to chess camp, that kind of thing. And every year he kind of you know, artfully dodges out of the request through like just his wit. He basically talks them out of going to these camps every year. But this year, he doesn't do that because his parents invite this wilderness expert played by Kevin Bacon, who couldn't be more than 23 maybe at the time this was made. He's obviously really early on in his career in this.
Right.
And he's sort of this wilderness expert. And he has a thing where he does a retreat where he takes a bunch of young men out into the woods, four or five, and takes them rock climbing, camping, really kind of intense rural activities over a span of like 6 weeks,
mm-hmm.
just out in the kind of the middle of nowhere.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Kevin Bacon does this really good job of playing this kind of like wilderness kind of, you know, spiritual, you know, kind of I'm from the earth.
Yes.
You know, kind of guy from that time period. Yeah. I mean, you see him, the way that you get to introduce that character in the movie is that he's walking around New York City with his like hiking backpack.
Yeah, well, like he's basically a rough and tumble man.
Yeah.
A man of nature, kind of juxtaposed with this urban environment when you first see him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very charismatic. He gives this little sales pitch to Sean Astin's parents about how this will help Sean Astin's character grow and really learn who he can be as a person. And he's very charismatic when you first meet him. And of course, his parents immediately go in for this idea. And Sean Astin's character is unable to talk his way out of going to this thing. So basically, you have this brief little moment where they introduce the concept of this wilderness retreat. And then, like, a minute later, Sean Astin is on the bus with the other four or five kids heading to this wilderness retreat.
Yeah, and you get the sense that he's one of the younger guys, you know, in the yeah. group. He's at this, you know, awkward age. That's like, this really this time that's kind of like middle school and high school.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of this awkward period where you're leaving your childhood behind and you're, you know, trying to come up in, you know, adulthood and going, you know, what do I want to do? Where do I want to be? Yeah. And there's a lot of, you know, like the guys that he meets, there's a lot of like, you know, there's a lot of picking on. There's a lot of like,
yeah,
you know,
they're basically
bullying.
They're basically, I think there's only three other people on this trip. There's basically four of them.
Yeah.
Four boys on this trip. There's one who's around his age. She quickly becomes friends with, and there's two older boys who look at they're maybe 2 to 3 years older than he is.
Yeah,
and they're much taller. They're obviously older, and they pick on him in that typical like bully sort of 80s movie way.
Yeah,
like they call him Dick Face,
mm-hmm.
And they push him around. Like, you know, typical 80s like I'm a bully. I'm going to be exaggerated and be mean to you kind of way.
I mean, and really, Sean Astin. I mean, it's just like. He kind of dresses down. He's kind of dopey. He wears his New York Mets hat, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I probably looked exactly like that when I was his age. I was wearing my, like, Chicago Cubs hat. And, you know, it's kind of that, you know, like, I mean, I should be at computer camp. Like, I shouldn't be here.
Yeah, I've got a photo of me from around the same age where I look shockingly like Sean Astin in this movie.
So, but you and I, like, we quickly identify, you know, with Sean Astin, right? Like, we know what it's like to be sort of like picked on by these older, more athletic guys.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so basically you have these kids being led out into the woods by Kevin Bacon. He's really, at this point, he's still kind of portrayed as this kind of charismatic leader. Like, they show him like driving their little van, singing songs, getting the kids kind of pumped up for their wilderness adventure. And during this time, I'm going to backtrack for a second. The movie's got a strange device in it where Sean Astin's character breaks the fourth wall in moments of the film where it cuts to him, obviously older,
mm-hmm.
and he addresses the camera directly, very much like Ferris Bueller, where he comments on what's happening to him in the story.
Right.
Like, he's like, there's no way I'm going to go on this trip. There's no way I'm going to go on this trip. And then they cut back to the main story, and he's on the trip.
Right.
And he's like, and then you cut back to him breaking the fourth wall. He's like, what am I going to do now, guys? I don't know.
Right.
It's very Ferris Bueller days. It's very Ferris Bueller days off, basically.
It is. It is. It really is strange at first, but then you get a more sense. To me, I didn't mind it as much because I felt like I got more insight to actually his character, mm-hmm. because when you see him react, He seems just very, when he's challenged, he's just like very sheepish and very quiet. Yeah. And I think it would be without those moments where he's explaining how he really feels, where he's like, I wanted to tell him this or I wanted to do this. And, you know, he kind of looks like very, you know, like you, I would have a harder time sort of identifying with him if I didn't have that sort of inner dialogue. Yeah.
And also, if you don't have that moment where he addresses the audience, he comes across as kind of a little bit, you know, snotty at times, because sometimes he's very shy and timid, but when he's defiant, or he really comes across as kind of a little jerk.
Yeah, like he's a rich kid. I mean, like when he's playing, there's a scene where he's playing the radio and Vic. You know, Kevin Bacon's character wants him to turn it off. And he's like, no radio, you know, and he's like, man, we're trying to listen to the Mets game. So it's like he's there, but he doesn't want to get involved into whatever is going on. He still wants to escape and still wants to be like in his world. And he's just like biding his time until he can go home. And Vic is basically not going to let that go. Vic is going to do everything that he can to like force him to like face his, like, you know, face nature and face his inner challenges and you know, like,
and at first you think, well, that's admirable because Vic's like, you know, put the radio away. I don't want to see it out again. I want you to enjoy the moment while you're here. I want you to be in the moment. And at first you're like, all right, I get that. Very cool. You know, it must be nice to have a character like that to look up to as a young man. Vic's very admirable in the beginning of the film, but as the movie goes on, his incessant need to be like, this is how we're going to do this. You're going to do what I say. Right. He gets more and more tyrannical as the film goes on. And it's kind of subtle, but it's also a little strange.
Well, I thought, as much as you want to give Vic credit, I mean, I saw it as kind of like, even at first, from the moment get-go, he was given, and we're talking about Sean Astin, his character name in the movie is Alan.
Alan.
So, I mean, he's given Alan like a hard time from the start, and he doesn't really give the same sort of attention to the other boys. So when the other boys pick on him and the other boys like don't follow the rules, he's just like, yeah, don't do that. You know what I'm saying? And they just kind of get a pass and they get to do whatever they want to do.
Yeah.
And it's because they're already experiencing like what Vic wants them to do. And I'm saying the rest of it, he doesn't really care about. So you immediately don't dislike this guy, like when he gets his knife taken away.
Yes. There's a point where Sean Astin, Alan, he basically is carving his name into a tree. And Vic finds out about it and makes this whole big to-do and takes his knife away. You know?
Right.
And it seems like a little bit of a sort of a mean-spirited thing to do.
Right.
And again, the movie kind of dances with the idea of Vic not being a good guy a little bit in the beginning, but as the movie goes on, there are other little things where it's like, well, that's kind of a mean way to be. Like, he tries to teach him how to fish at one point, and he's like, I'm going to teach you how to fish with your hands the way the Native Americans did in this region.
Right.
And he shows him how to grab fish out of the stream with their hands. And, you know, it's cool. It's cool to watch him do it. The kids seem to be into it. Well, Sean Astin goes off, comes back with a whole bucket full of fish, and Vic's like, that's amazing. You did such a good job. How did you do this? And he goes and shows him what the kid had done was he had built a contraption out of wood to trap the fish in a little gully where he just grabbed them and put them in the bucket. Like, they basically get stuck and they couldn't swim away.
Mm-hmm.
And Vic's like, that's not how I told you to do it. Tear this down and do it right. It didn't matter that he built it himself.
No, he didn't tell him to do that. He told him to tear it down, and then you're going to clean the fish that me and the other guy caught.
Yeah.
And you're going to sit here and clean this fish. And we're going to go across it was like a little island on this little in this lake. And they were like, we're going to go back on the shore to the camp. And when you're done cleaning, you signal and we'll come get you. And, you know, so he gives him this like super severe punishment for what, you know, Alan thought was like this very innovative, very imaginative, very sort of like, you know, thing that he created. Like, he improved on the idea. Like, he made this thing.
It was still hands-on. He didn't, like, use, like, fancy, like, tools to do it.
He just used stuff that he found around the island.
Yeah. And so, and that's first inkling that you get that, you know, Vic is, you know, he's not just being strict. He's kind of just being mean spirited because it's not going exactly the way he wants it to go.
Right.
And that becomes a theme as the movie goes on, where he puts these tasks in front of the kids and the other kids do it fine. But Sean Astin's character, Alan, hesitates. And Vic, for a minute, is like, you can do it. I believe in you. But the minute, you know, Sean Astin's character hesitates, Vic kind of throws up his hands and is like, well, you deal with that. We're going to go on. You can meet up with us.
Well, I mean, he did that. He did that like three times, basically.
Yeah.
The first time he did it is that Alan left the poles at this bridge. It's like really sort of rickety bridge that they had to cross.
Yeah.
And Alan had to carry the poles for the
tent.
For the tent. He left them across the side. So when they got to camp, he was like, oh, man, I left them. He knew where he'd left them because he sat over on that other side contemplating trying to get up the courage to actually go across.
Yeah, and to paint a picture for the people of you, for you, those of you out here who haven't seen this movie, which I imagine is most of you, imagine like the rope bridge from Temple of Doom, but even worse.
Yeah, because it's just one plank, like enough to get your foot, like 1 foot on.
Yeah, like you basically would walk heel to toe the entire time to get across it.
Right. And so he had to go across, and so he had to face his fears again. But this time he was just like, he couldn't do it, and he came back, oh, I can't find him. But like, so he made him go back like basically by himself in the dark to go get these poles and then come back.
Yeah.
But Vic wound up going to get him. He followed him and watched how he was going to react to that situation.
And watched him in the moment Sean Astin character Alan, he almost falls off the bridge.
Yeah.
And they imply that Alan watched him almost fall. I mean, Vic almost watched Sean Astin's character almost fall to his death and didn't do anything.
Yeah, he didn't step in and go, you know. So yeah, you have to question like, what is Vic really there for? I mean, he's the adult. Isn't he the one supposed to keep them safe?
Yeah, this whole thing above seems very not safe.
No, it's very not safe. I mean, above all, everything else to try to keep them safe. Yeah, you want them to learn stuff, but it's just like, you know, you have to accept, I think, if you're in that situation, like, kids are either going to pick it up or they're not. And you can kind of keep encouraging them to, but Vic was just, like, extremely forceful.
Yeah.
So that was, like, the one time. The second time was when they left him on the rock.
Yeah,
where they
had to swing by cords across a little gap in a mountain pass.
Right.
And he basically leaves Alan, Sean Astin's character, just dangling from this cord above a gorge.
Right.
Where he could have fallen to his death, but he was strapped in because when he swung across, he didn't make it all the way and kind of got stuck dangling in between the opening.
Right. Well, no. The thing is, before we get to that part, though, after, like, okay, so the bridge thing happened first. Second thing that happened was the fish thing where he gets left on the island.
Yeah.
Alan never signals. He never cleans the fish. He's like, no, I threw those fish away. What happened is the next morning, like you can see Vic like getting worried, like, is he okay? Is he okay? Is he okay? It starts to rain. He's left over there on that island all night.
Yeah.
So the next morning, Vic gets up, tells the other kids, he's like, hey, you go across and get Alan and come back. So they go over there and they're like, hey, come on, like, where's the fish? She was just like, no, I don't have the fish, I threw them away. Well, get in the boat anyway, come across. So they come across and then they can't find Vic.
Yeah, he vanished.
So now they're alone in the woods by themselves.
Yeah, no idea what's going on.
No idea. Yeah. They can't find him. They yell and yell and yell. The two older boys get into a fight.
Yeah.
One of the older boys winds up breaking the radio.
He becomes Lord of the Flies really quickly, basically.
Right. It's just like abandoned into chaos. And then when it starts to rain and starts to get cold, then they all band together.
Yeah.
And then like Vic shows up the next morning and was like, you did it. You survived.
Yeah. And that's a really cruel thing to do. And Vic, you know, kind of gradually is really shown as being maybe not the most responsible adult in the situation, almost to the point where he's not quite a villain, but he's certainly not a good person.
Yeah, so to Alan, he's like, well, first, you left me on an island all by myself all night. Now you've left all the rest of these guys and abandoned them. So he's like, so that was one of the, you know, times where he has that inner dialogue and he comes on camera. He goes, so pardon me if I'm not so, you know, excited to see him. And then later on they go rock climbing and he gets left dangling, like they swing across this opening where they're rock climbing, and all he's supposed to do, he's wearing it like a harness, and all he has to do is like a pendulum kind of swing out and go to the this other kind of platform. And you know, he didn't make it. Like, he just like barely missed because he didn't swing out far enough, right? So,
well, he got scared as any kid would.
Right. And he was like, oh, wait, oh. And then, like, you know, didn't push off, like, as much as he should have, right? And so,
And again, Vic tried to encourage him for a minute or two, but then he's like, look, you can do it or you can hang there. And even the other kids are like, what? You're going to leave him dangling there? And he's like, yeah, he'll be fine. Dangling from the side of a mountain.
For hours and hours on end. And, like, until it basically, until it's, like, dark time or time to set up camp.
Yeah, it's strange, ladies and gentlemen. It's a strange movie in that respect.
Well, I mean, and that's when the other kids started picking up on, wait a second, maybe you're being a little too harsh. Maybe you're being a little too mean.
Yeah.
We need to go back and get him. Like, you can't just leave him dangling from a rock.
And then Kevin Bacon's character, Vic, he's like, no, we're going to leave him there. And he actually gets into, like, a little scuffle with the kids.
Right.
And
he stands in their way, and they push, and he pushes back. It's like, no.
Yeah. And then eventually, you know, Alan, you know, Sean Astin does make it across the gorge, comes and meets them, and they kind of get into a little argument. And
no, it's because he says, because Vic again is like, yeah, you made it. Good. Great. And he's like, no, I'm leaving. I'm going home.
You're a jerk. I'm through with this. And everyone else is like, yeah, you've been a jerk this entire time. This is dangerous. We want to go home.
Right.
And Vic's like, no, you can't go home. We have so much more we have to do. I got so much more I want to show you guys. And they're like, no, we've had enough of this. Yeah. And they get into a little shoving match, and they shove Kevin Bacon's character.
No, well, they wound up leaving and then going back to their original camp, like right before they went across the like really scary bridge.
Yeah.
And that's when they meet Vic again. So they leave him there on the rock, and they get away, and they finally find their way, you know, back to back to where they were, back to their original camp.
Yeah.
And that's where Vic awaited them, and that's where they get into a scuffle, and that's where, you know, it's like, and then dude hits them with an oar.
And the whole thing takes a real, like, it's almost like Vic's going to become like a horror movie. You think he's going to start hunting the kids down and try to hurt them. It's really, the tonal shift is strange.
And he like pushes them, and they're like, and then like he hits them with the oar, and then they like throw a rock at him.
Yeah,
and
eventually Kevin Bacon's character Vic falls and ends up breaking his leg.
Right.
And the kids are like, oh, crap, we did not intend for that to happen.
Right.
So they use Alan's engineering skills that he showed when he caught the fish as a way to basically pull Alan up, save him, or pull Vic up and save him. And they basically tourniquet his leg, and three of the boys go for help, leaving Vic and Alan alone together.
Yeah, he's losing too much blood. Alan decides that, hey, we're going to go down, you know, the river, and he's going to brave it by himself. You know, they went down the river one time, and he chose Alan to go with him.
Yeah.
And he's like, why are you choosing me? I'm like the weakest one. I don't want to do this. Yeah. But that's when, you know, you realize that, hey, he's going to pick on him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that was kind of like foreshadowing,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, it's to show the arc of what the kid's gone through. In the first scene where they go through the white water, in the white water summer.
Yeah, right. Summer. See, he's starting to come together.
Yeah, see, Sean Astin's character, Alan, does a real bad job. He loses the oar. He loses control of the boat. But at the end, you know, he basically helps the injured Vic into the boat. And he basically controls the boat through very dangerous rapids and ends up basically getting Vic to a modicum of safety. That they end up breaking the boat regardless because the rapids are too rough. But
they went over like a waterfall, and they were like, no, he really kind of failed because they were like, well, you didn't make it. Well, he goes, I had to do something.
Yeah, you know, I had to try.
And then that's the thing is like where Vic left Alan before and was just like, you figure out whatever because we're leaving. They could have left him here like, well, we know where you are. We're going to go get help and we'll be right back. Alan didn't leave. Alan was kind of like the one sort of in charge. Like when he made that thing to like lift Vic up, he becomes like the de facto guy in charge.
Yeah.
So where it was kind of like Lord of the Flies before where like who knows what's in charge. And then, you know, Alan's kind of left to the side. Now, all of a sudden, Alan's in charge, and he's, like, directing traffic. Yeah. He's like, you go get help. I'm going to stay here. And it's like, and he made the conscious choice to, like, I'm not, as much as he didn't like Vic, he wasn't going to leave him by his side. He's like, I'm not going to do that to another person.
Yeah. He's going
to
show that he's better than Vic. Yeah. But not in a malicious way, just that he's just got a stronger character.
Right.
And in the end, they're kind of on the side of the river, and you know the rescue helicopter comes, and Vic and Alan have a little bonding moment where they admit that they've both been stubborn jerks to each other.
Yeah.
And they've kind of grown to respect each other. Spoiler alert, the end.
The end. Right.
That's how it ends. So let's, now that we've kind of inadvertently talked our way through the movie, let's talk about the way the movie's kind of made and some of the choices in it. I thought all the stuff actually in the woods was pretty interesting. Yeah. So there's some beautiful photography with them on the rope bridge and them climbing the mountain.
Yeah.
It's some really cool practical stunt work. Some of these scenes are really dizzying. Right. It's really impressive stuff.
Yeah.
And you know the ambiguity of the story in the woods to me is fairly interesting. You don't really understand a lot of the motivations for why they're acting the way they are, but it's at least got a point of view. What's odd to me about it is the asides where Alan is talking to the camera like Ferris Bueller. It feels like it's trying to position the film as a comedy. Like it really feels like those scenes feel like they belong in a comedy film, and the rest of the film is not really a comedy at all.
I think they had to do it though, because if you think about, okay, who is their core audience, right? It's going to be me and you, right?
Yeah.
And if you look at it, like, you know, I sat there watching, my wife watched it, and she's like, why is Kevin Mean such an a-hole? You know, why is he such a jerk? This is crazy. He is crazy.
Yeah.
And it is kind of like almost a psycho kind of thing where he's just like really almost like very mean spirited.
Like it could very easily become like a 1980s thriller. It really could.
Yeah. Like they could be like, we're stuck out with stuck out with these people. And, you know,
this like intense like nature guy who won't let us leave, and we're scared.
Right.
That could be the movie. And what's odd, if you look at the posters for, I pointed out to you earlier when we were talking about earlier, if you look at the poster art for this film, the original theatrical poster makes it look like, you know, your typical like Ferris Bueller kind of meatballs, you know, kind of farce movie. It's got a painted image of Kevin Bacon basically canoeing down rapids. Yeah. And Sean Astin's character is looking all like overly relaxed in sunglasses and a Hawaiian shirt. It looks very farcical.
Well, and you think it's like, it's called Whitewater Summer. You think it's going to be a movie like Meatballs or something. Yeah.
And it has like flashes of that, but it also has this other story that seems way darker in tone. But the other poster that was released later on for it looks totally like a thriller. It's got like a shot of like the rapids and the boat going over the waterfall. And it's got this really intense photo of Kevin Bacon kind of looming over it.
Yeah.
And nothing illustrates better to me how this is really a movie that's at war with itself over what it wants to be.
And that's funny because if you think about the movie, and I'll go ahead and reveal this now, the movie was originally made without the commentary.
Yes.
The commentary from Sean Astin's character, Alan, was made actually 2 years later.
Yeah.
And then when they released like later versions, it was with the commentary.
Yeah.
Now the reasons why it is, I'll reveal a little bit later, but it's kind of funny how the marketing for that also changed how they made the marketing, the original poster, like this fun thing, but it's really kind of a darker movie without the commentary.
Yeah.
Then they make a poster that's a little more, you know, looming or whatever with Kevin Bacon.
Foreboding,
that's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it's a little bit more lighthearted when you put in, like, you know, the funny commentary.
Yeah. Like, I've used this phrase before, but it's really a Frankenstein of a film.
Yeah.
It's like these two disparaging ideas sort of stitched together. And I would love to see the original version without the commentary, because one, the movie's not very long. I mean, with these scenes of him addressing the audience, the movie is literally 80 minutes.
Yeah.
Maybe 89.
Yeah.
So it's not even a full 90 minutes. And those you know, audience addressing moments take up like maybe.
Well, I think they had to cut some of the other movie out, maybe.
Yeah, I would love to know if there was a cut of the movie that had extra scenes set in the woods. I would be interested to see that version of the film.
I did actually see like when on the island scene where they're fishing. You did actually see the other kids have fishing poles, so they weren't just fishing with their hands.
Huh.
I think that they were, you know, maybe some of that, like you didn't see them catch some of the other fish. Like, you're just, like, thrown into seeing what Alan built, like, his little fish trap or whatever. And then, like, that's when everything sort of comes to light. So, that I think maybe some of that scene kind of maybe got cut.
Yeah.
Maybe some of the other joking scenes. Like, I remember there was a scene where one of the older kids, like, he bought a porno mag, like, at the...
Because remember in the 80s when you that's only the way to get pornography was you had to find a porno mag.
Yeah, at the convenience store.
Yeah.
Just like
another scene, like a kid today wouldn't have no concept
no,
of.
No, not at all. But yeah, and he was like, yeah, and he just like bought it, and the guy, even the adult just let him buy it, was like, hey, they got twins this month. Yeah. You know, he's like, oh wow. And he sticks it under his shirt, but you never see anything about it. Like, at all.
After that. Yeah.
There might have been something there that might have not.
And there's not a lot. I mean, this is the thing. It's not a lot of character development for anyone but Kevin Bacon and Sean Astin.
No.
The cast is very small. And literally every other character in the movie is very one-dimensional.
Yeah.
You've got Sean Astin's friend and the two bullies.
Right.
And that's really their entire defining character traits is, you know, friend and bullies.
Yeah. I think the guy that played... Chris, like Matt Adler, went to do some other movies like back.
One of them looked familiar, but I
yeah,
didn't
the blonde headed kid.
Yeah, I didn't look in to see what he had been in, but I know I'd seen him in other things.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's just I remember watching this movie on HBO, and it always had the commentary. I never saw the without commentary.
Yeah.
So I mean, I've always sort of enjoyed it, and to me, I think that when you're a kid, going through some of those experiences are sort of that thing. It is sort of fun, and it is sort of scary.
Yeah.
You know? And then when you're pushed, like, all the kids like me or like Alan, like, we've all been pushed in that sort of way. Like, oh, you're going to do it, otherwise you're just going to sit there. And it's just kind of like, and you know, we've all been, like, sort of picked on. And it's kind of like, kind of the nightmare, like, when it goes too far. You know, what are you going to do when you get pushed too far?
Like, to me, I think that would be a more interesting version of the movie than what currently exists.
Yeah, like just challenging himself just overcoming his sort of it was a weird way of him, you know, because really you see this transformation in Alan where he does come around, but it's just a really weird way to get there.
And also, for the only two characters to have characterization are basically Alan and Vic, neither of them are very likable.
You know? No, because Alan kind of becomes likable at first, but even I mean, or likable later
at the end. But for the most of it, he's kind of a little jerk.
Yeah,
and Vic is obviously a little psychotic.
Yeah, he's kind of a spoiled brat, and then you got a little psychotic mix, and then
it makes it a little hard to care about what happens to them.
And that was the funny thing, and that's the one of the great things I think about Kevin Bacon when I think about his acting skills.
Yeah,
you don't get a sense of that sort of like. Nightmare character, like you said, like, you know, when you first meet him, you know?
Yeah. And they even has a moment where when the kids kind of, when the kids run off from him at one point, they show him kind of around the campfire by himself, and he seems genuinely sad that they left.
Yeah.
Like, he seems kind of heartbroken that they didn't want to continue on the adventure with him. And Kevin Bacon, he's a wonderful actor. He really is. And he can nail all those emotions.
Yeah.
Beautifully. And he's really the main reason the movie works at all.
Yeah, I think so. Because he was real calm, and he was real, like, because if he was sort of psychotic all the way through, it would have been...
You're like, I'm not going to send my kid with you.
Yeah. No, his character is very dynamic. You know,
and he's very charismatic in the beginning. Like, he's like, you can see why kids would want to, why parents would be willing to give their kids to him for a month or two.
Right.
Even when he's, like, driving him to, like, the wilderness retreat, he's, like, singing songs with him, and he gets the kids, like, pumped up, just, like, singing silly songs. And you get why people would want to follow him, but you can also get why that kind of character, why that kind of personality could very quickly turn ugly if you didn't do what he wanted you to do.
I mean, when he was giving his presentation to, you know, Alan's parents, I'm like, yeah, I want to go on this trip. This looks like a fun.
Sounds pretty great.
Sounds pretty great. And, yeah, like you said, they're singing along, they're having a great time, and... He's showing him, like, he does this thing where he does really catch a fish, you know, this, like, trout, like, with his hands. I mean, how cool is that, this guy that you're with can
pretty,
do that?
It's pretty cool.
But even
when things go well, the entire thing seems really dangerous.
Yeah.
Like, when they're climbing the mountain, it looks really unsafe. Yeah. When they cross that rope bridge, it seems really unsafe.
And really, I was thinking about that. When you are out in the wilderness like that, at least nowadays, I know you can't just deviate from your plan.
Yeah.
Because of those reasons. Because of if you don't hear back within a certain amount of time, they go looking for you.
Yeah.
And that's why he's like, oh, maybe we'll go north. Like, well, nowadays you can't. I don't know about 1986 or 1985 when they filmed it, but I'm like, nowadays you can't really do that.
Because
when you go in on the wilderness, they
want to know exactly where you're going.
Yeah, they're very specific about a plan and a route and, you know, where you're going to be and how long you're going to be there and where the stations are if you do get into trouble. Like, you know, they're very more specific. They don't just let anybody, you know, kind of go into the wilderness like that without some sort of plan.
Yeah. You know? So, and also, yeah, and this, I think that line of dialogue about maybe we'll go north is also to show that Vic, you know, Kevin Bacon's character, was not as much in control as you wanted to believe in the beginning, that he was kind of doing a little bit of this, just playing it by ear.
Yeah.
And it kind of added to the sense of anything could happen because, you know, it didn't seem all that well planned out.
I just think about nowadays, like the amount of lawsuits that would happen.
Yeah, that kept thinking, like, this would never happen.
No.
You know, even in like the 90s, they'd be like, what? No.
Well, I mean, can you imagine if Alan actually, you kind of get this sense at the end of the movie where it's kind of like, you know, there's a mutual understanding. Like, I'm not going to tell, like, the crazy things that you did.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I'm saying, like, we're going to kind of protect, you know, each other.
I'm not going to tell people that you threw a rock at my head and tried to kill me.
Right. You know, and I'm not going to tell them.
Take you camping.
Yeah. Right. And I'm not going to tell on you that you, you know, hung out on a rock for like a day, or I left you out in the rain for 2 nights, you know, or whatever.
Yeah. Movies like that only exist in the 80s, which is some of the fun of this podcast, I think, is
But can you imagine how Alan's parents would react and be like, yeah, he just left me hanging on a rock for like four hours.
They would sue him. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, they would own his backpack or whatever he owns.
Or like, oh, you crossed a bridge and didn't help him out. He almost fell to his death.
Yeah.
He was hanging on by just his leg.
Yeah.
Like, what? Anyway,
yeah. And also, this is the third type of things that movies maybe believe are more common than actually are in real life. I thought these are kind of rickety rope bridges were everywhere.
Yeah,
when I was growing up because they are in every movie.
Well, that
from this time period,
that and quicksand.
Yeah, that and quicksand, which we've talked about before. Callback, but yeah, like I thought these like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom rope bridges were everywhere in the woods. When I was growing up, and I've yet to see one, and I am 40 years old now.
No, I've seen some swinging bridges, but they've been, you know, like steel reinforced, like steel cables and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and they're kind of maybe a little bouncy, may get you a little heart pumping for a second, but, you know, yeah, nothing like you ever see.
This looks like some like ridiculous, like, it's just like some Indiana Jones nonsense. It's.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to Lucas.
Okay.
All right. So Lucas is a much more popular movie. It stars a young Corey Haim and also Cary Grant and also a very kind of young Charlie Sheen.
Mm-hmm.
Also stars Courtney Thorne Smith, Winona Ryder, and Jeremy Piven.
Yeah, a lot of people were in this movie when they were young. The Jeremy Piven still looks kind of old.
Yeah, he does.
But we'll get into that in a minute.
It is Winona Ryder and Jeremy Piven's first movie.
Yes, Winona Ryder looks young in this.
Like, yes.
Like she looks like she's like 14.
Yeah, and she looks even younger with that like pixie haircut of hers.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is when I started remembering. I'm like, no, this is where you first see Winona Ryder. I remember seeing her in Beetlejuice, but you know, it wasn't until later that I got like the two girls were the same girl because her haircut is like so different.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, so, and you know, when you're a kid, you don't piece together things that well, you know.
No. So Lucas is about this sort of accelerated, weird, odd kid who is in high school, but he's probably like a couple years advanced.
He's 14. He said
14,
and
right.
he looks like he's a he may be a junior.
Yeah,
I don't think they see quite what grade he's in, but you get the idea. He's been in high school for a few years.
Yeah, and he's just really socially awkward.
Yeah, He's nerdy. He likes science. He likes reading about the law. He likes reading about insects.
He likes classical music.
Yeah.
So then Carrie Green, she's like the new girl. Yeah. And he like falls in love with her, just smitten with her.
And to explain who Carrie Green is for people who don't recognize the name, she is Annie from Goonies.
Yeah, she's in Goonies.
Yeah,
which Sean Astin is also in Goonies.
It's all connected.
So yeah. It's all connecting now. Yeah. We're all starting.
But yeah,
to make
this sense. She's very much Annie from Goonies. For those of you who don't recognize the name, you know, typical like eight when you're a little kid, you were in love with her in the 80s. I'm sure every kid was.
She's the cheerleader type, you know, the kind of like the nice. Very sweet cheerleader type.
Yeah, they were the approachable cheerleader.
Yeah.
And this,
the girl next door type.
Yeah, and it's perfect casting because very early in the movie, you see Lucas going out on one of his little insect hunts, and he happens to stumble across her playing tennis, you know.
Yeah.
And she's new in town, and he immediately is smitten by this wholesome, pretty girl.
Yeah.
And she's nice to him. She talks to him, asks him what he's doing, and she seems like she's genuinely interested in what he's got going on. And, you know, as a little nerdy kid, he's not used to that. And he immediately falls in love with her.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, for that very moment.
Well, she's new in town. She doesn't have any friends. So she, like, you know, chats with him for a second and tries to find out. And so he's like, okay. So they start hanging out together.
Yeah, because she doesn't know anyone.
Yeah. And so he starts showing her around things and showing her insects. And, you know, they start having, you know, fun during the summer because there's not really much to do.
Yeah.
And so she's like, okay, I'll, you know, do this because they're in a small town.
Yeah.
And, you know, she doesn't know anybody.
Yeah.
And she just becomes friends with him.
Yeah. And there's this really wonderful scene where he basically takes her into these pipes, these like sewage pipes. And you wonder what he's doing with her. But basically, they're sneaking into the local outside opera that's going on. This is very early in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like they're navigating these like sewer pipes. You're like, what's going on? But when they get to the end, Lucas moves the mantle cover, and they're right there where the orchestra is playing this beautiful classical
music.
Right in the front row. And you get the idea that he comes and sits there and listens to the opera for free all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a funny little moment where he asks the guy actually watching the opera if he can see the program. And
yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, it's really cute and sweet. And you're like, you know, but she's 16. He's like, 14.
And they basically sit back to back below this mantle cover. And it's a really beautifully shot little scene. And they're listening to this beautiful music. And you can just see the love that he has for this girl all over his face. And it's heartwarming. And in a way, it's heartbreaking because you know it's not going to work out for him.
Yeah.
But it's just... It's such a pretty little moment. It's such a nice moment. It's actually what they use for the poster art for the film is this little scene.
Well, that's the thing. It's like she, you know, and then, you know, when they actually start school, things start to change.
Yeah.
She starts to pull away. She starts to like, maybe I want to be a cheerleader.
Yeah.
Maybe I like this football player, Charlie Sheen.
Yeah.
And starts to, and she's, you know, he's kind of like, well, playing football is superficial. Like, you know, cheerleading is superficial. Yeah. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, just because in this, and she realizes that what he tried to keep from her was he's not a popular kid. He tried to pretend to be popular when he wasn't at school. But the minute they get back to school, they realize, oh, he's kind of picked on by people.
Yeah.
And he has friends. He's got his AV buddy, and he's got this other little girl played by Winona Ryder who obviously loves him to death. Which is one of the more sad and frustrating things about the movie is young Winona Ryder is obviously in love with Lucas.
So Corey is Lucas. Carrie Green plays Maggie. Charlie Sheen plays Cappy Rowe, the captain of the football team.
Cap.
Winona Ryder, she plays Rena.
I don't think they ever say her name in the
movie. Yeah, they do. They say Rena a couple times.
Yeah, well, Rena is obviously very much infatuated with Lucas because she's a bit of an outsider too.
Yeah.
And
she thinks he's smart and, you know, she thinks he's kind of cute, you know.
But you know, Lucas only has eyes for this other girl, and it's a little heartbreaking.
Yeah.
The other girl ends up meeting
Maggie.
Cappy.
Maggie.
Thank you. They say her name a ton in the film. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Maggie ends up meeting Cappy, played by Charlie Sheen, who again is very young in this film. Very I actually forgot. Charlie Sheen used to be dashing.
Oh yeah, of course.
Like he
of course.
He was quite a young movie star when he was that age.
Oh, of course,
man.
Yeah.
And he's and what's what I like about this is the way this movie subverts expectations because Cappy, you know, Charlie Sheen's character is the captain of the football team, But he's not mean to Lucas. He actually likes Lucas.
No.
And defends Lucas and helps Lucas.
Yeah, they go out to the, even to his other football players. Like, he's not afraid to stick up for him when other people are around.
Yeah.
I mean, he has, like, serious integrity. And that's one of the things that Maggie sort of, like, really likes and is really sort of, like, almost, like, sort of turned on by is the fact that he does protect Lucas.
Yeah, because she cares about Lucas, too. And they both care about Lucas.
Right, because she's like, well, I'm friends with him. He's a really nice, you know, sweet, like, very smart guy. Like, yeah, he's a little bit awkward and whatever, but, yeah, that's part of his charm. That's who he is, you know?
And just the nuance that's really nice in these kind of movies. So you don't normally see in the movies where like, you think that the jock character is going to always be anti the nerdy character.
Yeah.
And in this one, they actually like each other and that they help each other and they have a real three-dimensional relationship.
Yeah.
And
when you find out midway through the movie, she asked about it, like, why you stuck up for him, you know, because they were at the movie theater and, like, the other football kids were, like, picking on him and stuff like
threatening that. Threatening to beat him up.
And so he sticks up for him. He's like, no, if you're going to beat him up, you got to beat me up first. And, you know, kind of steps in the way. And you know, he asks him, you know, later when they're just, like, by themselves, why do you stick up for him? He said, well, he did something for me once.
Yeah.
And she finds out that, like, what he did was when they were, like, in middle school, like, he was really sick with, like, hepatitis or some sort of
something that caused him to be home and miss out of school
for like 2 or 3 weeks. And so Lucas would bring his work to him.
I mean, he would tutor him. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, that's really nice of Lucas to do that. And Cappy goes, yeah, especially because I wasn't nice to him either back then. But he chose to be nice to me regardless.
Yeah.
And if that alone should make you makes Lucas really endearing. It's a nice little bit of character building because if you weren't on Lucas's side before that, you were really endeared to him. At that point, when you realize even when the kids were being mean to him, he was still willing to help them.
Yeah.
And that helped Cappy grow and become a better person.
Mm-hmm.
And it made Charlie Sheen more likable, too. But invariably, you get these two attractive kids together. They're going to end up kind of having a thing for each other.
Yeah.
And that leaves Lucas as the odd man out.
Right.
And he doesn't get that Rena likes him. You know, he's very fixated on Maggie.
He's too focused on Maggie.
Which happens a lot, I guess, with kids at that age.
Yeah.
They get tunnel vision. But and that causes Lucas to basically act out.
Yeah, he does. He wants to join. He said, well, okay. Well, because basically Courtney Thorne-Smith, played by Elise, like, she's real jealous of Maggie. And she basically gives Cappy an ultimatum and says, you know, you have to, like, I don't want you to see or talk to her again. You either have to choose her or me. So he's just like, all right, fine. So he starts to, you know, go out with, you know, Maggie, basically. And then this is what breaks, like, Lucas's heart.
Yeah.
And this is what's, like, says, okay, well, if basically decides in his mind, if she likes a football player, then I want to be a football player.
Yeah, I'm going to be a football player. So this little kid, he's little in this movie.
Oh, my God, he looks so little in, like, the football uniform. And
yeah.
Stuff. And I think they purposefully picked a bigger helmet.
Yeah, and bigger
because they probably
pads,
could have found a helmet that could fit. Yeah. But I think they chose.
He is easily 2 to 3 feet shorter than every other kid on that team.
Yeah,
and so he looks tiny, tiny.
Yeah.
But to go back to Charlie Sheen for a moment and that little romance between those two characters, one of the other things I liked about it was you don't get the impression that they intended to end up together. Like, Maggie and Cappy didn't intend to, you know, hook up, you know. Cappy.
No, she didn't want to break up their relationship. She was just, like, talking to him because they were talking about Lucas and stuff. And she's like, yeah, she kind of looks at him like, he, like, you know, yeah, but I, you know, she knows that she can't do anything because, you know, because they almost have a moment where they almost, you know, could have kissed when they were, like, you know, downstairs in, like, the laundry room.
And they were just talking.
Talking, but she was like, no, you know what? I'm not going to push this. I'm not going to do anything.
The movie does a really good job of making all the characters really likable for them. All the characters who are really a main part of the story, you like them and you want to see them happy. And the frustrations that Lucas goes through and the heartbreak he goes through is really heartbreaking because he's such a sweet kid. And everyone in the movie is just, they're nice people. And you want it all to work out and for everyone to be happy. But you know that's not what growing up is. There are going to be hurt feelings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's going to be some lessons learned. But you want it to all work out in a magical way where no one's going to get their feelings hurt. And it's just kind of just waiting for that to for the feelings to get hurt, you know, because it's inevitable.
Well, and instead of letting it go, he decides to fight against it, right? Well,
that's what any 14-year-old does at that point.
Would you join? I mean, but would somebody do something that stupid, though? Like joining the football team as 14 years old?
I think
that's some of the
dramatic qualities of film. Yeah. But I think the spirit of the idea is, Eric, like, kids that age can be very stubborn.
Yeah.
They can latch onto ideas to the point of being a little self-destructive.
Yeah. But you're talking about a guy, you know, who's kind of like this Sheldon Cooper-ish kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Where he's like super smart, but not really super self-aware.
Yeah.
And he's going to do this thing and then like not self-aware that like, yeah, you're going to get like severe, like injured.
Yeah. Like he believes he can outrun the guys basically because he's smaller.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, he's like, yeah, I'll just pretend they're big and mean because if they do catch me, like, I am dead. So that should make me a better player. So he goes out. He threatens to, like, sue the coach basically for not letting him play. And, you know, the principal says, well, okay, fine. Well, we need your parents' permission then.
Yeah.
Bring your parents in.
And that's one of the plot there that's kind of goes throughout the movies. Like you mentioning, you know, we need to see your parents. And Lucas always says, well, my parents are busy. My parents don't have time for this. They keep Lucas's parents kind of vague and mysterious all the way through the film.
You never meet his parents.
Yeah, we don't even really find out much about Lucas's life away from school and away from Maggie up until the very end. But the way he gets onto the football field at the end, and that's one thing I say, we mentioned the football stuff a lot. The football stuff in the end of the movie is really only like the last 20 minutes of the movie. It's pretty short because basically he gets onto the field. The coach is like, what are you doing? You're going to get hurt. And he's like, listen here, you dumb jock. You're going to let me play football. And I think he cusses them out. He really talks a lot of mess to the coach. And the coach is finally like, you know what, you little punk? Get in there.
Yeah. Like, you want some abuse? Like, you're going to face, like, even, like, you know, he's going to see what it's really like by getting in there, you know?
Yeah. And, again, this thing that would never happen nowadays.
No, because it's like, how does that even happen? Like, even back then, you had to submit a roster of who were your official players and who was not. And then, like, they're just going to let this guy go play.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, just like, yeah, just go in out there. Just go out there. Because it was, like, it was already at the end of the game.
Yeah.
It was already, like, fourth quarter.
They were
like
losing.
Two minutes to go, and they're losing, like, 40-0.
And Lucas has a moment where he catches the ball and has, like, a little dramatic moment where you think, yeah, he's going to do great. And then he gets creamed. And he gets creamed bad. He gets hit so hard, his helmet flies off.
Right.
And then a bunch of kids dogpile on him, and he gets hurt.
Yeah.
And he ends up in the hospital. And to tie back into his parents, they go try to find his parents. And Rena's like, well, you don't know where he actually lives. Let me take you to where he actually lives. And you find out that Lucas lives in a trailer park.
Yeah.
And his father is an alcoholic who's not around.
Yeah. He lied to Maggie that he lived in this nice big house.
Yeah.
He didn't want to let Maggie think less of him, you know. Yeah.
And he had been telling people all the time that his father was a lawyer and his mom was an activist and things like that. And I kind of got the impression that maybe Lucas had even been abused, because there's a little throwaway line by Cappy where he talks about earlier in the film how all last year he talks about how Lucas walked funny. And Lucas, when he asked Lucas about it, Lucas said, oh, well, something about the gravitational pull of the earth made him walk funny. But all I could think was he probably was getting beat by his alcoholic father and didn't want to let people know. That's why he was walking strangely.
I see. So I kind of got that. I remember he mentioned the alcoholism I think he drinks a lot. And then Arena was like, yeah, I don't think there's a mom. I think there's a dad, you know, like, whatever. I don't think the mom's in the picture anymore or whatever. Yeah.
And it's just, they really just, it's kind of beautifully understated. Usually they show Lucas's real home and it's this really crappy trailer. It's very sad looking. And you realize why this kid is so full of bravado and is trying to build himself up to be better than what he actually is, because he comes from such humble and meager, kind of awful beginnings.
Yeah.
And again, it makes you even like the kid even more.
I know. But and then let's get to the final scene, because, I mean, it's a pretty popular movie.
Yeah.
So there's a scene in the hospital where he sees Maggie and he wakes up and he's like, oh, did we win? Like, no. And then she's like, you gotta stop doing this. He's gotta stop. He's like, okay. Yeah. And then can we just be friends? And then that's when he sort of accepts, like, okay, yeah, we can just be friends. Like, I can see, I can't do anything now. He's kind of defeated, but he's kind of like, he realizes that he can still, be close to her and be friends with her and not, he did everything that he could. And so he goes back to school and everybody's like, oh, there he is, you know. And even the football player who, picked on him the most, he's like, yep, there he is. And it's like standing there with his arms folded, waiting for him to open his locker. And everybody's like gathered around and, you're sitting there thinking like the tension's building. Like,
are they going to play a prank on him or
they're
something?
They're going to play a prank on him. Or are they going to really beat him up for embarrassing them at the football game or something like that? Yeah. And Lucas just sheepishly opens his locker and there's a letter jacket.
With his name on it.
Right. And back then, I mean, really, you only got letter jackets. I mean, it's still, if you played a sport.
Yeah, you had to be part of the team and a significant part of the team. So it's a beautiful gesture from the team. And at that moment, when he finds the jacket and he puts it on, everyone starts clapping for him.
It's the slow clap.
It's the slow clap to be
clarified. Yeah, where there's the one guy who starts very widely and deliberately, like clapping, very slow pace, and then it just ramps up a little bit.
And you had a theory that this was maybe the first big use of the slow clap in 80s movies.
Yes, we'll get to that. Okay. I've got some more data points on
I'm curious to hear about that. But yeah, so basically the movie ends with them clapping and Lucas raising his arms triumphantly. Rena's there, Maggie's there. All the characters from the movie are kind of there watching this.
Yeah.
And they're all kind of sharing this triumphant moment with Lucas. And then the film freeze frames with him with his arms in the air, 80s style.
Right. And you get the idea, Maggie's standing next to Cappy. You get the idea of they're together.
Yeah.
And
it's not a bad thing.
No.
It's a good relationship. And everyone's going to grow. And you get the idea that maybe Rena will finally talk to Lucas about how she feels.
Yeah.
And, they'll find each other and everything will be okay.
Yeah.
And it seems kind of schmaltzy, and it is, but it's such a nice, good-hearted film. Right.
Well,
likable characters. The smallest is nice.
Know? And I think that thing, changed his whole trajectory in high school from being this really nerdy kid that now everybody gets to see what sort of depths that he's going to go through. Yeah.
How much heart he has.
Yeah, exactly. How much integrity and stuff that. Like, he's willing to get out there on the field and do some crazy stuff.
Yeah, just he's willing to take some lumps. Just to prove that he belongs, and they end up begrudgingly respecting that.
Yeah,
which is kind of that's kind of the young nerdy dream is that if they can only know what kind of character I have, then they would appreciate me and not pick on me. It's kind of all that personified into a film,
right? And by doing that, whoever does like later on pick on him is going to be just like a big jerk.
That's from the next time all the school will come to his defense, basically.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. It's really a wonderful 80s movie that I'll be honest with you, I had never seen it all the way through before this watching. I had seen two scenes of it on HBO when I was a kid. I really liked it. I mean, it's really good.
I think the first time I saw this movie, it was on it was probably a year after it was released. And it was on HBO and we were on vacation on our way to somewhere. Florida or something, and we stopped at a hotel, and we're what's on TV tonight? And then what's on, because you got HBO and Showtime, and that was one of the movies that we watched. That
it was on first HBO time all the time.
I remember watching that, and the reason why is because I also sort of identified with Lucas in feeling that sort of that alone, sort of lonely feeling, that you want to have somebody else to connect with, and you want to have friends, and you want to have a girlfriend, and you want other people to like you and
you
not pick
belong.
On you. Yeah, right, exactly.
And when you're that age, you don't feel like you belong a lot of times. And when you're into nerdier things, you definitely don't feel like you belong.
So in watching it now, it was a much harder watch because it's kind of like reliving those painful memories.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of middle school and how awkward and alone I felt.
Yeah.
You eventually come out of that. We've grown up. We're now middle-aged.
Yeah.
And, we've had a lot of good experiences in our lives. And it's interesting to go back and think about what it was like to be that kind of awkward, kind of nerdy kid who just wanted to belong.
Right.
To feel that way again. And that's why I'm gonna wax poetic for a moment. That's why movies are wonderful.
Yeah.
Because they're like empathy machines.
Right. That's true.
You can all of a sudden plug in and just feel that feeling again. And it can be like this warm blanket of nostalgia with a little bit of almost beautiful sadness on top of it.
And it was more sadness than nostalgia, but sure.
Yeah. But I really liked it. And I regretted not having seen it before now. I mean, really, really enjoyed it.
Wow.
And, you know, if I had seen Winona Ryder back then, I would have fallen in love with her even sooner.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was great. Even the few scenes that she's in, I mean, it's just like man.
She's luminous. Not to be weird, but she's luminous, even at that age.
Yeah, I think at that point I was in love with Cary Grant, you know, I would say.
Yeah,
would
Goonies, say.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and Corey Haim, awesome. I don't think that there's any other actors around that time period that could have pulled that off like he did. Because I'm thinking about like River Phoenix or who's the guy from Stand By Me? I mean, I know Corey Feldman. Like,
you're talking about not Jeremy London.
No.
What's his name?
But anyway, but yeah, I know Corey Feldman.
Will Wheaton?
Yeah, Will Wheaton.
I forget Will Wheaton.
I don't know. Sorry, Will.
We love you, Will.
Yeah, it's our brains, man. We do this like after work at like 6 o'clock, and our brains are fried after a full days of work. I know Corey Feldman. You know, was up for this part as well.
Corey Feldman would not have done as good a job.
No.
And really one of the great tragedies in Hollywood is that Corey Haim had such a rough childhood actor life. I mean, he was a victim of abuse. He got into drugs. And he died tragically young. He died younger than we are right now.
Yeah.
He died at age 38.
Well, and even I mentioned River Phoenix. I mean, River Phoenix did as well. Yeah. I mean, he kind of had a really spiral out of control, abusive with, you know, abusive drugs. And then, you know, Corey Haim did too. This was also the movie that Corey Feldman claimed where there was some sort of sexual abuse going on.
Yeah, I wasn't going to bring that up. But yeah, this is the movie that Corey Feldman claims that this is the movie where Corey Haim was first abused. It kind of began his life of getting abused and drug abuse.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of separate that from the movie because the product is a wonderful, sweet, affirming movie. The behind-the-scenes stories behind it, if they are true, and I'm inclined to believe they are, are sad.
Right.
But my point was, Corey Haim, if he had gone down a different path, could have been a wonderful actor even nowadays. And to me, it's a true tragedy what happened to him. And this movie is a testament to how talented he was.
Right.
And how much raw charisma he had.
Well, because you see, because even in other movies like License to Drive,
he's
a completely different character. He's the character with a lot of self-confidence. He's the character that's like, I'm going to take this girl out and I'm going to do all these things. And
we should do License to Drive on the show for sure.
We need to do that one as well. That should be in like maybe we'll do a coming of age 80s part 2.
Yeah.
And we'll do that
License
one.
License to Drive and we'll find something else to go along with it.
Yeah.
But he was really talented. And he's kind of – him and Feldman have both become kind of the butt of jokes in the modern day. And I think it's really unfair because if you go back and look at the work they did, they were supremely talented kids.
Yeah.
And their story is a true tragedy.
I mean, Corey Feldman was in Stand By Me.
He's great in Stand By Me.
He was in Lost Boys.
Which he's really good in.
Yeah.
And I mean – but at least we have movies like this. We have movies like Stand By Me to remember that these guys were great. They were wonderful young actors. And again, despite all the tragedy that happened to me, it was a lot of tragedy.
Right.
At least we have these wonderful examples of them showing how great they could be.
Yeah. I mean, the same goes for River Phoenix, who was in Stand By Me as well.
Oh, River Phoenix was so great in a lot of movies.
Right.
We're going to get to River Phoenix eventually when we feel like being sad on this show.
Yeah, like My Own Private Idaho those kid actors that were on all of like the teeny bopper magazines when we were a kid, like all the girls that we knew were in love with those guys and in love with all the guys from the TV shows like Kirk Cameron. We're not going to talk about Kirk. We're not going to talk about
this podcast is anti Kirk Cameron. I just want to stress that again. Yeah, I would punch Kirk Cameron in the face.
We're pro Corey Haim and pro Corey Feldman, but we are anti Kirk Cameron.
Yes, and I will go to I will die on that hill. Oh,
sorry. Hello.
Yeah, I got all staticky. Oh, it's your mic.
It's my microphone. I'm sorry. Okay. My cables are bad. So,
Let's see. We can cut back. I will die on that hill. I will punch Kirk Cameron in the face. Callback to our very first episode for our loyal listeners who have been there since episode one.
Yeah, all right.
But yes, I will say that I am pro Corey Haim and Corey Feldman. I think they got a really unfair shake, and I think Lucas is a great movie.
And to go back to the one of the first things I forgot to mention, one of the first things that we talked about, I looked it up. It didn't take me this long to look it up. I just failed to mention it after I looked it up. That what's his name? Gosh, Sean Astin. He actually, his first movie was Goonies, but there was another movie that he did in between, like Father Like Son, mm-hmm. which stars Kirk Cameron. That's what made me remember.
Isn't that a body swap movie?
Yeah, that is a body swap movie.
Yeah, which kind of got me
but
started
on
how much.
He plays one of his friends or something like that. Yeah.
But that's actually what brought up my original distaste for Kirk Cameron.
Yeah, right.
I think he's an awful human being.
Well, that's why I tied it back into that.
But anyway.
But that was the second movie. So the third movie he did was Whitewater Summer.
Okay. So before we get into trivia, I got to ask you.
Okay.
Now, if we were into these movies from the video store, would you keep Whitewater Summer for an extra day, or would you turn it back in early so you wouldn't have any late fees?
Turn it back in.
Same here. I don't think I'd ever watch Whitewater Summer again. I don't regret watching it.
No.
But it is a deeply flawed movie with some good elements.
It's still confusing over we're watching a thriller or we're watching a coming-of-age film. And I think that it really, as a coming-of-age film, it goes a little too far.
Yes.
And I think as a thriller, it's like not really that. I mean, it's kind of a thriller, but you have to get to the very end to get to that part. So it's kind of, we don't really know where we're going with this.
Yeah. And what about Lucas? Would you keep Lucas an extra day?
Keep it.
Yeah. I would actually try to buy it from the video store.
Yeah, so I would too. I want to own a copy of it.
Yeah. And I want to say, if anyone's interested in these movies at this time, they're available to stream on Amazon and iTunes.
Yeah.
I know we were worried that Whitewater Summer may be too obscure to find.
Yeah.
But it is available currently to stream on Amazon and
iTunes. Amazon Prime. Get a plug for Amazon Prime.
Yeah. Please pay for our podcast, Amazon.
VideoCulturePodcast@gmail.com.
Yes. Hit us up with any kind of sponsorship, you know, things. Also, Winona Ryder, if you're out there, you know,
we love
email
you.
Us.
We love you.
Yeah.
Just wanna, love
can't
to
stress that enough.
We'd love to hear from you anytime.
Yeah.
We know you're kind of married to Keanu Reeves, technically, but
we think
care.
He's great, too. If you want to bring him on the show, that's wonderful. Can't wait for Stranger Things the next season.
So, Whitewater Summer trivia. Oh, gosh, my mic is messing with me again. All right, here we go. It was originally produced as Rights of Summer in 1985, and it was given its current name when it was released in 1987.
And even then,
so the entire marketing campaign completely changed.
Yeah. And even Rights of Summer sounds like it would fit that wilderness movie way more.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah,
like,
Rights
like
of Summer.
Whitewater Summer sounds like you said, it sounds like Meatballs.
Yeah.
Like, but Rights of Summer sounds like that's going to be a movie about ruggedness and really
more
learning
like
about
the,
who you are.
Like The Lord of the Flies. Like, yeah. The narration, like I said, was added 2 years later.
He looks so much older. Releases. Yeah.
Yeah, he does. I mean, and I think that adds to it. So, but, you know, we always think about, like, why did producers make these sort of, like, things? And so when it was originally released, they only released it in the Northwest. So it was shown for like 2 weeks up in like Oregon and Seattle and like select theaters, and you know, during that summer, and that was it. And they never shown it again. I mean, if you look at the actual box office numbers, it only made like a little over $300,000. Yeah. And you're thinking like, that's a lot of money. Like, no, you have to consider, like, movies that came out, like, during the summer, like, I mean, even bad movies, like, make a million or two.
Well, and they would play for a long time as well.
Yeah.
Because they did stagger releases back then where they would roll them out to different cities.
Yeah.
The idea that it only played in one area for a very short period of time, that's pretty unusual, especially for a movie that had some star power in it.
And it's Columbia Pictures.
Yeah, which that was a big releasing studio. It still is.
So that the film was photographed by John Alcott, a frequent collaborator of Stanley Kubrick. Oddly enough, I don't know why that tie-in.
Well, and I got to say, some the wilderness stuff all looks very pretty.
Well, it's shot in California's Sierra Nevada mountains as well as western Quebec, Canada. But most of it was shot in Sierra Nevada. So if you want to get out there and look at that beautiful scenery and go camping, and maybe Kevin Bacon will go with you.
Yeah, I'm not a nature guy, but any of our if any of our listeners go, by all means, tag us in photos on social media.
Right. There's two songs by one of my favorite groups, Bruce Hornsby and The Range, on the album from the Way It Is album. So the first song that you hear is The Wild Frontier.
Oh, yeah.
And then also there was another On the Western Skyline.
That's a great song.
Yeah, I think On the Western Skyline is like, you know, as they're traveling out, you know, towards, you know, the mountains or whatever. It's a great, like, you know, it's supposed to mean the lyrics are kind of like from a trucker's perspective.
It's got driving a majestic quality to it, for sure.
Yeah. Journey is also on the soundtrack. So one of the reasons why I started looking at, like, why these producers make this choice of, you know, whatever, is, like we said, I think it's partly because of the you know, it's a mixed up identity, right?
Yeah.
But it was against films during the summertime of Revenge of the Nerds 2, Dragnet, Adventures in Babysitting, Full Metal Jacket, Predator, Roxanne, Innerspace, and Beverly Hills Cop 2.
That would have been a great summer at the movies. That's a lot of fun stuff there.
I know, right?
And Dragnet, you say?
Dragnet.
Interesting.
That's a fun movie. All right.
Huh. Mm. I haven't thought about Dragnet in a while. Yeah. Hint.
Maybe we'll do that on another episode. All right. So, did I mention Innerspace?
Which I love Innerspace.
We have to do that one too.
Yeah. It's on the list.
Okay. So, the movie, of course, was not reviewed by Roger Ebert.
Really? I'm kind of surprised.
Well, it's a small release. I mean, there's so many movies.
I just assume he saw everything.
No. And even later, like, I looked on his website, no mention of it whatsoever.
Yeah. It's a pretty obscure movie, considering who's in it. Yeah.
24% rating on Rotten Tomatoes from critics.
That's probably harsh.
54% audience score.
That's surprising.
I think it's because of people like me who saw it and identify with it and still kind of have this either nostalgia or this, like, kind of, you know, facing our fears when we're that age kind of thing.
It's not terrible. It's just a confused movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, but that's all I got. There's not really
information on that movie.
No.
Yeah, this is kind of, to me, this movie is almost the essence of what video culture is all about.
Yeah.
Because this is a video store movie one remembers.
I mean, it's almost like a step to, you know, straight to video.
Yes.
Like one step away from being straight to video.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about Lucas. Cary Grant, she wasn't in really much after this. She went on to star in a movie called Three for the Road and appeared in a few TV shows, but eventually she dropped out of acting and studied art at Vassar College. She eventually founded a film production company for independent women artists with Bonnie Dickinson. And with Dickinson, she co-wrote and directed a film adaptation play about teen pregnancy called Belly Fruit in 1999. So
I've actually not seen it, but I've seen that in, like, lists of movies. I had no idea she was involved with it. That's interesting. I may check it out just because of the connection.
So in Three for the Road also stars Charlie Sheen. So, but yeah, it's kind of weird. Like you say, like, we fall in love with these stars, and then we don't know what happened to them.
Yeah, because to me, she will always be as she was in these two movies, because it's very much a time capsule of her at the time of Goonies.
Yeah, because she did, like, Goonies, and she did this movie, and that's where everybody knows her from. She didn't really do a whole lot after that. Yeah. In the climatic football scene, the cheerleaders for the opposing team, the Rockford Rockets, were real-life Chicago Bears cheerleaders.
They did look older than the other girls quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, it was filmed around Chicago, like in Illinois. So, yeah. So, you mentioned before about the slow clap, okay? Mm-hmm. And this actually might have been the origins for the slow clap. And I did a little research. I had to go beyond just, like, the facts that I can find, like, within Wikipedia and stuff like that. I had to kind of look up a few things and do a little bit more deeper research. And here's what I found out. Some people say that the first slow clap in movies was in Citizen Kane in 1941, where the character is watching a play or opera, and the scene ends. A few people start to clap, and then the character who's watching from a private, like, room, balcony, he stands up with excitement and then, like, has this really sort of deliberate slow clap. Yeah,
it's been memed quite a bit in our current culture.
But the problem with that is it doesn't really follow, like, the main, what we think of the slow clap. The slow clap has to start with the slow clap. Mm-hmm. And then other people have to join in until it's a crescendo.
Yes.
So this was almost like the opposite, right? It starts with a few claps, and then he joins in.
Yeah, you told me that you looked for other examples in film, so, and you couldn't find a lot.
All right. So in Meatballs in 1979, that one begins with a chant that's kind of like a bum, 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 and then that kind of erupts, you know? So there's a scene with Bill Murray, and then it kind of starts as a chant, and then and kind of breaks it into a crescendo. So I don't really consider that one either. It's not really a typical...
It's not a traditional slow clap like what we're thinking
of. Cliche-ish slow clap. Yeah. That's what I'm getting at. There's no slow clap in some, and this is where I'm trying to get rid of the Mandela effect, where you think that a slow clap is, you know, where you've seen it in other movies before. Yeah. So there's no slow clap in 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, or Ferris Bueller. Okay, so get that out of your head. Yeah. Weird Science, some people say that there's some clapping after they get rid of the road warrior from their house when there's a party.
Yeah.
That was, you know, and that was 1985, which falls in line with Lucas, which is 1986. But in that scene, you can hear some kind of clapping, but it doesn't, like, a lot of people don't really join in. Yeah. You just kind of hear it in the background.
Yeah.
You know? So that one, I say, okay, that's not really, I said, not really cliche-ish.
Yeah, it's supposed to be deliberate that builds to a crescendo.
Right. And it's also not in Revenge of the Nerds or the Revenge of the Nerds 2, oddly enough, even though that there's a couple times where you think that they would fit, where they would be like, okay, this is, you know, somebody gives a really great speech and, you know. No. The closest example that I found was in this movie from 1974 called It's Good to Be Alive. And it's, I believe it's a baseball movie. And it stars Louis Gossett Jr. And one of the players who hasn't played in a while, like, he comes out and, like, there's somebody who recognizes him and then just starts this kind of, like, clap because they start to see him and recognize him, and then it builds into a crescendo. But to me, once again, I think that that was not really a deliberate, like, you know, thing where everybody's, like, looking at him. It's because somebody notices him and then starts clapping and then starts to build up. It very well could have, that could have been the inspiration, but, I mean, Lucas was the one where it's, like, very sort of 80s movie-ish cliche.
Well, and it ends the film. It's sort of the punctuation point on the entire film. And when you think of 80s films, the slow clap is often cliche, is often parodied when people are kind of talking about 80s films. So at the release, I think we can safely say that Lucas popularized this slow clap.
Well, let me just mention the movies that the slow clap was in the same sort of fashion that Lucas was in, the same sort of cliche scene that we're all familiar with that happened after Lucas. Okay. Can't Buy Me Love, Cool Runnings, Rudy, Jersey Girl, Intolerable Cruelty, Against the Ropes, and Not Another Teen Movie.
Yeah.
So, and then really, I think Against the Ropes is probably the most modern example, I think. But really, I mean, it's almost the, and then when you want the closest example, I think, to Lucas was Can't Buy Me Love. I mean, yes. that scene is, it's not the ending scene, because there's still kind of a prologue that happens after that, but it's really the sort of like changing scene where, you know, somebody does something out of integrity, and then like they have like a slow clap, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know.
Which one of those weird things you don't think of when you sit down and watch these movies, that you're going to see something that became a staple of a style of movie.
So, but there you go.
There you go.
So to me, in my mind, I feel that Lucas is the first sort of like version that we all know, the cliche-ish version of the slow clap.
Well, I think you made a compelling point, and I think that if we are way off base, people will let us know.
That's right.
Yeah, so if we are way off base, you know, feel free to argue with us. You know, go to our website, video-culture.com. Find us on Twitter at videoculture2. Talk to us about this. Is this the origin of the 80s slow clap?
Right, yeah.
You know, what do you guys think? Let us know.
Yeah, discuss it. I mean, I'd love to. I tried to find like YouTube clips of all these like movies. I can't find them all, but you can find some that are out there. But yeah, I think it's when I did. So there is one slow clap like montage, and it ties in a few of the movies that I just mentioned, you know, but the oldest movie I still think is Lucas. Roger Ebert, as far as like Lucas is concerned, what do you think he gave it?
I'm going to say he gave it. He does a 4-star scale.
Yeah, 4 stars.
I'm going to say he gave it 3.5.
4 out of 4.
It's a really good movie.
He says, calling it a film about teenagers who are looking how to be good with each other, to care, and not simply be filled with egotism, lust, and selfishness, which is all most Hollywood movies think teenagers can experience.
He is such a good writer. He encapsulates what we said. It took 15 minutes to say in about a minute. Yeah, that's it right there. He was amazing. We miss you, man.
Yeah,
Roger, you were wonderful. That's a beautiful way of saying that.
It's included in Roger Ebert's list of top 10 films in 1986.
It's definitely good.
Yeah,
it's. I mean, like I said, I was surprised how great it was.
Yep. 70% ranking on Rotten Tomatoes for both critics and audience score.
I figure the audience score would be a little higher, but you know, it doesn't really matter. I mean, great film's a great film.
I think some people might think like when you go back and watch the original, like when you go back and watch the original Soul Clap, you think, oh, well, that ending's like kind of cliche-ish. But then you think, I think that's like the original form of it. You know what I mean?
Sometimes people, when they look at the movies through modern eyes, they have trouble seeing, they have trouble placing it in the proper context.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing that I always try to do, and I really encourage our listeners to try to do, is when you watch these older films, and we really do encourage you to watch these things, try to think about what it would have been like to watch it at the time it came out.
Right. And it's hard to get that sort of Hollywood sort of, sort of expertise on like all of these little things that they put in, because I still think that they, you know, all these, you know, a lot of these films borrow from other films, you know, they like see what works, see what didn't work, and see what they can put in or whatever, you know, like, oh, you know what worked great for this film? We'll put this in here and do this thing.
You know? Yeah. I tell you, Lucas definitely influenced a lot of films.
I think you're absolutely correct. Because I think, like Roger Ebert said, it showed, you know, it showed teenagers for real characters and not just like they want, you know, like I think License to Drive, even though it's a great movie,
all farcical, and Lucas is not a farce.
No. You know, I mean, I think, you know, movies like, and that's why one of the reasons we love Stand By Me. It's sort of the same sort of thing.
Well, if Lucas came out nowadays, it would be a heralded indie drama that people would be talking about. It'd be like up for Independent Spirit Awards if it came out nowadays.
True.
But because the night period is kind of lumped in with these other teen movies of this time period, when really it's a cut above a lot of those in intent and in execution.
Good one. It is ranked 16 on Entertainment Weekly's list of 50 best high school movies. So, and that's
pretty high.
So that's all the facts I got. There wasn't a lot of facts or trivia. I mean, I think that's the biggest amount of trivia, though, that I think I can pull out.
That's okay. You know, that's still, I mean, well, there's not much information out there. There's not much information out there. What matters is Lucas is a movie you guys should see.
It is. It definitely is.
It gets a strong recommendation.
Yeah, and usually a lot of movies that have a lot of stuff, there was a lot of drama around it. And I don't think there was a lot of drama in making these movies. You know what I mean? So, So in a lot of these movies, they're even childhood stars. They're known to other kids. You know, a lot of people weren't really watching a lot of stuff that was going on at the time. You know what I mean? So,
well, also I think Lucas is such a nuanced film. It's the characters are three dimensional that it's very relatable even nowadays.
Yeah,
like you could show a movie Lucas now to a kid who feels disenfranchised, and they would get it.
Yeah,
and get something out of it, which you can't say that about a lot of the films that came out in the 80s.
Well, that's because you still, in high school, you still have football that reigns supreme. You still have cheerleaders, which, you know, reign supreme. And you still have people that are in band, like Lucas and Raina. Yeah. You know what I mean?
There will always be popular kids and outsiders.
Yeah, there's always the
universal things.
Cheerleaders and the football players, and then there's the people in the band. You know what I mean? Okay. So.
Well, do you have any recommendations to go along with these movies this week, Ryan?
I do. I have a couple.
Okay.
Rudy.
Rudy, of course.
That is Rudy, because, I mean, it's Sean Astin, and he plays a football player, and he plays this, you know, small guy who wants to be on the Notre Dame football team and, you know, eventually does get to play a couple of, you know, fourth quarter, you know, downs or whatever. Yeah. And really shows, you know, once again, I think it's a lot like Lucas, where he's kind of like chasing after a dream that's really kind of like, why are you trying to be a square peg in a round hole? Just be a square peg, you know?
So, but it's about heart. And, you know, you're right. That's a wonderful movie to pair with Lucas for sure.
Right.
What was the other one?
The River Wild.
Oh, The River Wild is a great movie.
So this is a show, Meryl Streep and Kevin Bacon, where Kevin Bacon, he plays like a character, like a thief or whatever, or escape convict.
He kind of plays, he plays like a criminal who basically kidnaps a family who are on a whitewater rafting vacation.
Yeah.
It's a great little thriller. It's an excellent choice, and it plays into the themes of Whitewater Summer. In a lot of ways, better than Whitewater Summer does.
I mean, it really is. Yeah. Like, you were explaining, like, it should have been, you know, like this thriller with Kevin Bacon. I'm like, I think that's
The River Wild, which I saw in the theater, and I didn't even make that connection. Yeah, it's an excellent film.
All right.
So I've got one recommendation. I think that'll pair well with Lucas. Can't Hardly Wait.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Kind of 90s version of the John Hughes films type thing. It's about kids are going to a house party, the last house party of their senior year, and all these little stories converge at this house party. You know, you've got your jocks, you got your nerds, you got your cool kids. You know, hijinks ensue, lessons are learned, friendships are made, people grow up and mature. It's very much kind of an 80s movie. It just happens to take place in the 90s. It's fun. It's got a lot of heart.
Mm-hmm.
It's quotable.
Yeah.
It's a really nice movie.
I think that movie is kind of like sort of in between the kind of like shenanigans of American Pie and the kind of like good-hearted sort of nature of, you know, and the warm, fuzzy feeling from like John Hughes films.
Beautifully said, my friend. Beautifully said.
Yeah, right.
And I think any of those films would go great with Lucas. I think... And Greg, great call on The River Wild. That really is Whitewater Summer, but improved.
Yeah, basically, yeah, because it's from a – and really, I don't think I've even seen that movie, so I think I'm going to have to watch it.
You haven't seen The River Wild?
Yeah, I've seen parts of it.
It's good.
I know that Kevin Bacon, like, he kind of plays a sort of deranged, you know, guy who kidnaps the family because Meryl Streep is kind of like on her – there. She's on this, like – some adventure vacation or whatever.
Yeah. Well, let's just say we're not done with Kevin Bacon on this show by a long shot. Kevin Bacon is going to be one of the kind of reoccurring, you know, actors we mention a lot on the show because he's in so many movies and so many of them are worth talking about.
Yeah.
But
this is, you know, another movie. If you want to connect, You know, Sean Astin, you know, he's been in a lot of things. So you just need, if you need a movie with Sean Astin and you're Kevin, you know, seven,
yeah.
you know, to Kevin Bacon, then, you know, you got in.
You got Kevin Bacon to Lord of the Rings in one step.
And bam, bam, right there.
In one step.
One step.
Yeah. So I think that's a good place to end it on, my friend.
All right. Well, thanks very much for listening. I'm Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Estrie. Go watch some movies, guys, especially Lucas.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
About you.
Really?
What are you doing? You collect insects?
Well, to collect them, you have to kill them. I just look at them.
That's nice.
It's perfect. Your name's Maggie.
Perfect.
You don't like
them? I do too.
It's nice to know somebody has really heavy thoughts.
If you're so depressed, how come you're eating pizza?
I'm a party animal.
Not everyone has to be glamorous to have someone fall in love with them, you know.
I wouldn't stick around to see the movie. I'm going to be looking for you guys afterwards.
It's called the process of natural selection.
It's suicide. He's gone out for the football team.
Well, the males who demonstrate physical prowess are the most attractive to the females.
This equipment just doesn't fit.
It's you that don't fit.
What'd you say?
All right, come on.
You heard
enough.
Me?
What position?
Prone.
Focus!
You're more big.
You're not cut out for this.
You have no right to stop me.
Lucas, you and I were just friends.
You can't make me quit! Ever!
How wonderful you are.
Like the way you're thinking now.
Lucas.